by its taste and high excitement, by the quality of its films and the intelligence of its sellout crowds, it may well mark for Americans a redefinition of what movies are and who it is that sees them. For in the decades since Hollywood came unstuck and television became the reigning medium of mass entertainment, the movies have suddenly and powerfully emerged as a new and brilliant international art, indeed as perhaps the central and characteristic art of the age. At the heart of the new movement is a hearty little band of inspired pioneers. That's from a cover story in Time magazine called A Religion of Film, marking the launch of the New York Film Festival in September 1963 and a growing American interest in foreign films. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
What is the history of foreign films in America? What did filmmakers from France, Germany, Japan, England, and other countries add to the screen? Which critics controlled the fate of foreign films? How did major stars and directors such as Brigitte Bardot or Ingmar Bergman affect attitudes toward foreign films? Why did the market for foreign films decline in America? Joining us for these and other questions is Tino Balio, UW Professor Emeritus of Communication Arts and author of a recent book from UW Press entitled The Foreign Film Renaissance on American Screens, 1946 to 1973.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you.
To write a book on this topic, you must have seen some kind of a pattern that other people didn't see.
Well, I first became interested in the subject when I wrote a history of United Artists Corporation during the 50s and 60s, and in trying to figure out how the company rationalized its production, I discovered that it had an art film subsidiary called Lopert Films that was very active during the 1960s and 70s. And that was my first insight into distribution of foreign films by a major company. And as a result of this, when an opportunity arose to apply for a grant from the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, I did. I proposed writing this history, and I was surprised to get the award. And that was close to 10 years ago. And I spent much of my life since then, since I retired, writing the book, and I'm very happy that it's now done. But this is a little explored period in American film history. It's very important. Certainly, many, many, perhaps hundreds of books have been written about the auteurs, the major filmmakers, analyzing their films, but very little has been written about the marketplace in which their films were received in the United States. So I saw this as an opportunity, and I enjoyed the process.
Well, tell us about the history of foreign films in this country. Where do you first see foreign films coming into the United States, and how are they received?
Well, foreign films first came into the United States around 1896. The Lumiere brothers sent their actualities to the United States, and they competed head-on with Edison films at the very beginning of the American film industry. But it really wasn't until the 20s that certain types of foreign films became well-received in the United States and played in a few art houses. But at the end of the silent film period, this phase of film history ended because the talkies really represented a whole new series of genres and styles, and the first, you might say, art film market of the 1920s died, and films re-entered, foreign films re-entered the United States during the 1930s. Lots of them did, but the vast majority of them played in ethnic theaters throughout the country. As you know, in major cities, there were German towns, Chinatowns, Japan towns, and so forth, ethnic enclaves. And these ethnic enclaves played foreign language films in their original foreign language. There were only a handful of art houses in the country. During the 1930s, New York had only four, and Chicago, San Francisco, Los Angeles had a few as well. So you could probably count the number of art houses in this country on the fingers of your hand before World War II.
How would you define an art house, by the way?
Well, an art house is a term that was used by the industry to designate those theaters that tended to specialize in the exhibition of high-quality foreign language films or British films. typically, the ambiance of an art house is quite different from a typical Hollywood theater. During the 1930s, the typical downtown Hollywood theater was a cavernous building, seating 2,000 or 3,000 with a vast balcony and a lavish decor and so forth. But an art house typically was a smaller, more intimate space. Typically, the design was more modern, but clearly it attempted to create a very comfortable, intimate space for the viewing of films of higher quality. Typically, these art houses, especially in the 1950s and 60s, differentiated themselves from the downtown motion picture palace, you know, by serving fine coffees and chocolates, and maybe they had film magazine racks in the lobby, or they converted their lobbies into art galleries.
Starts to sound like Sundance to me.
Right. Well, precisely. There's a long history to this. Absolutely.
What role did the critics play in making these foreign films known or even popular in the United States? I gather probably these films weren't heavily advertised, wouldn't have anything like a Hollywood budget, would they?
Not at all. Most of these, the major criticism on the part of the trade press about foreign films is that they came into the United States unappreciated, undervalued, and underpublicized. And as a result of this, film critics played a significant role in the acceptance of these films in the United States. Almost all of the important foreign films that came into the United States that entered the art film market had a New York City launch. This was required to gain some sort of national recognition for these films. Otherwise, they would not be known at all. And in order to have a successful New York City launch, a distributor would have to find a first-class art house, and there were any number of them during the 1950s and 60s, with the hope that after the film opened in New York City, it would get a rave review from Bosley Crowther. Bosley Crowther had a life and death control over these films, but fortunately he was a great fan of foreign films. He particularly liked those films, those foreign films that had social themes to them. And if he gave a film a rave review, there'd be an excellent chance that the film would be picked up for distribution outside of New York City. But of course, New York City was the center of the media in the country, and foreign films would be reviewed by Time Magazine, Newsweek, The New Yorker, The New Republic, Esquire Magazine, and also the trade press. And this was great publicity for a foreign film. It received a positive review because most distributors and most art house owners did not have the budget to widely advertise their films. Besides that, most art house patrons did not really believe in advertising. They believed in reviews, and they respected their friends' word-of-mouth recommendations for the films. So the word-of-mouth really played a crucial role in the acceptance of foreign films after the war.
Did you find, as you were looking at attitudes towards foreign films in this period, and you're particularly looking at the period starting right after World War II, mm-hmm. that xenophobia or American attitudes towards different countries, different cultures played a role in what was accepted?
Well, yes. Clearly, after World War II, America was less of an isolationist country, having won the war. And they were more receptive of things foreign, you could say. And clearly, with all the hundreds of thousands of servicemen coming back to the United States, many of them entering higher education through the GI Bill, they introduced a worldview that was really quite different from people's worldview before World War II. But to answer your question specifically, it's ironic that one import trend that was extremely popular immediately after World War II came from Italy, a former enemy. And these films were beloved and loved and actually helped to jumpstart the art film market after World War II. We did not see films from Germany until much later because, having won the war, the Allies prohibited the German government from actively they dismantled the German film industry, and we didn't see any significant German films coming out of that country for well into the 60s. And another surprise, in 1950, we received another film from a former enemy from Japan, which was extremely popular and helped to jumpstart interest in Japanese films beginning in 1950. And, of course, that film is Rashomon.
Well,
Akira Kurosawa's film.
There is a Kurosawa, of course, but from Japan, not art films by any stretch, but those science fiction films became
very
popular.
Later. They became a little bit later. Yes, Godzilla became a landmark film and was a very important film for the Japanese film industry, now that you mention it, because most of foreign language films that played the art house circuit only generated a moderate amount of money in the marketplace. On average, these films generated about $100,000 in rentals, which was really small potatoes. But Godzilla generated millions of dollars. And this, of course, is what national film industries wanted. They didn't particularly want their films to play in the art house circuit. They wanted their films to play in the mainstream exhibition market where they could generate significant money. And in the case of Japan, it was Godzilla and all the Godzilla remakes and sequels and God knows what.
Well, how big a role did the rise of television play in the success of foreign films in this country? I mean, was the movie theater in this country looking for some way to compete?
Yes, this is a very important issue because beginning in 1948 with the rise of commercial television, motion picture attendance declined by 50% within a decade. And as a result of this, Hollywood dismantled the old studio system method of producing large numbers of films. They stopped producing B films. They stopped producing cartoons, newsreels, and cut back even on the production of Class A films. And Hollywood, in order to attract an audience during the 1950s, began to specialize on what we call today as blockbusters. But this created this dismantling of the studio system created a product shortage for certain types of theaters in the country, particularly subsequent-run theaters that relied on double bills and relied on the Class B films and the cartoons and so forth. When Hollywood cut back on production, there were a significant number of neighborhood theaters, subsequent-run theaters in this country that faced a significant product shortage. As a result of this, over 4,000 theaters closed their doors during the 1950s. But some neighborhood theaters, some subsequent run theaters in certain locations could convert to an art film policy if they wished. These typically were smaller theaters in college and university towns and in some larger cities as well. So you might say that Hollywood indirectly provided an impetus for theaters in this country to accept foreign films.
Obviously, the big barrier is language. You know, do you use subtitles? Do you dub in voices?
Yes.
How do you overcome the moviegoer who thinks, well, I'd like to see the film, but I don't want to spend the time reading the film?
That's right. Well, that's a very good question. But the audience that first received foreign films after World War II was identified by Variety as the lost audience. And by that, Variety meant that this was an audience that Hollywood never really catered to in a significant way. This was a more mature, affluent audience, highly educated, an audience that enjoyed classical music, fine books, and fine food, and so forth. The art film market attempted to target this audience segment. And this audience segment preferred watching foreign language films subtitled rather than dubbed. And there was a raging controversy. Well, maybe I'm overstating that some, but there was a controversy throughout the 1950s as to whether or not foreign films should be dubbed, because most commercial theaters in the United States would not play a subtitled film. Therefore, foreign language films were forever confined to what was called the art house ghetto. But in order to reach a wider audience, distributors face the option of dubbing some of their films, which they did, but the vast majority of them played subtitled. This was the preferred method of consumption for this lost audience during the 1950s. The controversy would heat up in the 1960s, especially when more and more international co-productions came to the United States. An international co-production might have a European director and a star, one star from France, another star from Italy, and maybe another star from the United States. These people would speak their own language when the film was being shot, and later the film would be dubbed into whatever foreign language was required to distribute that film in any individual country. So when an international co-production came to the United States, it was typically dubbed into English, even though the participants came from all around the world.
That in itself would be a challenge. You mentioned the Italians as being the first really to break into the American market in a big way. Was there a particular film, an Italian film, that opened the way for all this?
Yes. In 1946, the film that really generated interest in foreign films in the United States was Rossellini's film Open City, which was a resistance film, an Italian resistance film that became enormously successful. It ran for 21 months in New York City, and it had a longer run than The Birth of a Nation or Gone with the Wind before it.
Wow. What made it so appealing?
Well, that's a very interesting question. The film starred Anna Magnani and Aldo Ferbizzi. And Rossellini was extremely adept at generating interest and sympathy for the simple people, the simple Italians in this movie. And he certainly depicted the Nazis and the Gestapo in an extreme manner, but he was able to build up an enormous amount of sympathy for the simple people in this film, these people who fought the Nazis and who ultimately died at their hands. All the heroes in this film are shot or killed by the Nazis, but the film had a sense of immediacy about it because of its style. It was depicted by Bosley Crowther and other critics as a film that had a documentary look. It had a sense of immediacy about it.
Black and white, of course.
And, of course, it was in black and white. And this film generated an enormous amount of sympathy. And it depicted the Italian resistance movement. And in a sense, because this film was successful in the United States, it was a public relations triumph for Italy. Now, after 1946, the Italians had discovered a way to enter the art film market, and from 1946 to around 1950, any number of Italian neorealist films came to the United States. But the numbers were not that great. We're talking maybe about a dozen films. So it isn't a flood of Italian neorealist films that came into the United States during this time, but they won all the top awards. Oscars, awards from the New York film critics, and so forth. And as a result of these films, the cachet, you might say, of Italian neorealist films and some foreign films really began to become enhanced.
What about France? You know, we think of the French as having a more open view of sexuality, for example. To what extent did French films bring in, I guess, some sexual side?
Yes. The French films were all known for their sophisticated handling of sex. They were never explicit until a certain point in film history. But after World War II, any number of French films came to the United States. But these were typically prestige films like Beauty and the Beast and Symphonie Pastorale and many others that were representative of a type of film that the French produced during this time that were called films that were produced in the tradition of quality. These were films that had international French stars that were based upon literary properties and tended to play to a more mature audience. The interest in French films did not really generate much heat in the art film market until the 1950s with the arrival of Jacques Tati's film, in particular Monsieur Hulot's Holiday, and then some thrillers such as Diabolique and Rififi and Wages of Fear. And then at the end of the decade, we had the arrival of Brigitte Bardot, and she was the most successful French import ever.
Well, before we find out exactly what she was importing, is there a quality, a style to these French films that we don't see elsewhere? And if we're not really getting that explicit about sexuality,
sure,
what is it that these French films are doing that's different from others?
Well, okay, that's a good question. The Italian neorealist films were successful for very specific reasons. First of all, they had a documentary look. They were shot on location with available light. And the most endearing quality of these films was that they often used non-professional actors. And these non-professional actors were able to elicit a great deal of sympathy and understanding, especially because the Italian neorealist films were social problem films. And you actually saw and empathized with these people.
Everyday
people who were enduring these hardships such as unemployment and what have you. But the films from France were produced within a different tradition. They were produced within studios with professional lighting, well-designed costumes, all of the accoutrements of an established studio system. So they had a totally different look from the Italian neorealist films. You might say they were at an opposite spectrum in terms of style. They had better lighting, better sound, and they had established actors and actresses, well-known international French stars who were playing the major roles, whereas the Italian neorealist films had unknowns for the most part.
All right. Now, about Brigitte Bardot and censorship, were those films in which she starred in France cut when they came to the U.S.?
Sometimes. The first film that came over that established her and that caused the Bardot revolution was And God Created Woman. This film was released without a production code seal, which meant theoretically that all the nation's commercial theaters would not play it. And it was also condemned by the Legion of Decency. Now, depending upon how you look at it, these are either pluses or minuses.
Exactly.
And in the case of the art film market, these were pluses because art houses did not necessarily abide by the Motion Picture Association's guidelines concerning the production code, and they were free to exhibit films that were condemned by the Legion of Decency. So Brigitte Bardot's film had to get through censorship. Now, there was still a prior censorship and censorship boards in the United States, and sometimes bits and pieces of scenes had to be cut, or certain scenes in which she was unclothed had to be camouflaged in a certain way. But basically, her films did not exhibit explicit sex by any means. But what captivated people in the United States was Brigitte Bardot as an example of a wild French youth.
Question about ratings in general then at this point. Could a person of any age go into any movie theater in this country, including an art theater?
Yes. It wasn't until the production and rating system in the end of the 1960s that there was an age designation appropriateness that would keep younger people out of a film. But during this period, anybody can go into to see any Hollywood film, certainly. But some art houses did not allow people under the age 17 in the theater because they wanted to create an ambiance for adults, and they didn't want any commotion created by teenagers. But this had nothing to do with the content of the films, but everything to do with
a tone.
Tone. That's right. That's true.
We're going to talk more about the history of foreign films in this country when we continue in a moment with University of the Air. What critics call dirty in our pictures, they call lusty in foreign films. That's a comment by Billy Wilder. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Tino Baglio, and we're talking about the foreign film renaissance on American screens from 1946 to 1973. We were just talking about Brigitte Bardot and her appeal. What would you say the significance of her presence in foreign films was, if you look at the whole picture of this industry?
Yes. The company that released Brigitte Bardot's first film in the United States was Kingsley International. And Kingsley International was the new subsidiary of Columbia Pictures. The Motion Picture Association of America prevented its members from releasing any film that did not have a production code seal of approval. But Columbia Pictures saw this film and saw that it presented a great commercial possibility. So they bypassed the regulations and just hired Kingsley International to distribute the film, and Kingsley International became an art house subsidiary of Columbia Pictures. This marks the entry of Hollywood into the business. United Artists would follow suit by forming an art house a subsidiary which allowed it to release certain films while still being a member of the Motion Picture Association of America. And during the 1960s, we see every other major Hollywood studio entering the market. And by the end of the 1960s, the major studios had absorbed all of the major European auteurs with production financing deals, which is something that independent distributors could not do at the very beginning or throughout this entire period. Because at the very beginning of this market, it was dominated and controlled by numerous small independent distributors. I mean, they were small. But by the end of the 1950s, Hollywood had entered the scene. So that's the real, you might say, economic significance of Brigitte Bardot, other than the fact that after her first film, the market was flooded with old Brigitte Bardot films, new Brigitte Bardot films, and on and on and on. But this craze lasted maybe for 3 or 4 years.
How did it affect the production code? Was there a general loosening of the strictures in this country?
Well, yes. The production code was being battered throughout this entire period because foreign films, for example, were leading the way in attacking motion picture censorship as an institution. We could look to a very famous Supreme Court decision in 1952 involving Roberto Rossellini's film The Miracle. And the distributor fought the censorship of this film all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court, for the first time in the history of motion pictures, read motion pictures into the freedoms of the First Amendment. And then throughout this period, any number of foreign film distributors challenged the censorship of certain of their films until by 1965, the whole mechanism of prior censorship in this country was totally dismantled. Meanwhile, the production code continued. Hollywood, in a sense, hid behind the production code until the other distributors and other entities in this country tore down the whole concept of motion picture censorship.
Out of curiosity, what was in The Miracle that led to its censorship?
Well, the Roman Catholic Legion of Decency thought that the film was sacrilegious because Anna Magnani, who was the star, who was simple-minded, playing a simple-minded peasant, meets a man who happens to be a passerby, who is played by Federico Fellini, by the way. And she thinks of him as St. Joseph. And she wakes up in the morning and then later on discovers that she is pregnant. Anyway, this was deemed to be sacrilegious. And the Legion of Decency, other Catholic pressure groups, attempted to close down the theater that showed this film. And there was a big fight that took place in New York, and eventually the distributor took the case not only to the censorship board in New York City, but in the state, and then ultimately to the U.S. Supreme Court. The Supreme Court welcomed the case because this was the first censorship case that was heard in this country since 1915, which help to establish the whole mechanism of prior censorship in this country. By prior censorship, I mean that there were censorship boards in many major cities and many states in this country that had the statutory authority to review a film before it was shown. And if the censorship board, which had no real particular set of guidelines, could determine whether or not a film was appropriate to be shown and to be given a license. But after this prior censorship was dismantled, distributors no longer had to present their films to the censorship boards prior to a film's release. A film could always be attacked for being lewd or what have you. But anyway, there were more guidelines now, legal guidelines, as to determine whether or not a film was suitable for release.
Well, you have films at this point like Blow Up and even I Am Curious Yellow coming into the country.
Yes. I Am Curious Yellow, of course, came out in 1969, well after the production code and well after the dismantling of prior censorship. And as a matter of fact, because censorship had been dismantled in the United States and because the laws pertaining to obscenity were so vague, these factors gave rise to a pornographic film industry. So, as you know, in the early 1970s, we had films like Deep Throat, Behind the Green Door, and others being shown in commercial theaters. And it's odd, ironic, however you want to call it, that this film, Deep Throat, played in the same theater in New York City that Open City did. 1946.
Some irony in that.
Yeah, right.
Speaking of Open City, was there a sort of a second surge of Italian films, Italian directors after Open City?
Yes. Beginning in 1961, we have a second group of Italian imports, and they comprised the films, some films of Federico Fellini, Michelangelo Antonioni, and Luchino Visconti, to say nothing of another series of films from De Sica as well. And this group of films from Italy constitutes what is called the Second Italian Renaissance.
We get into Zeffirelli, too, don't we, at this point?
No.
A little later?
Zeffirelli comes later, and he was not really part of this coterie. He became best known in this country for Romeo and Juliet, which I think came out about 1967. That was more of a commercial film than an art film.
Where does Sophia Loren come into the picture?
Right there, with the Second Italian Renaissance. In addition to such films coming to this country like Fellini's film La Dolce Vita, Antonioni's film L'Avventura, and Visconti's Rocco and His Brothers and The Leopard, we have a series of films that were collaborations between Vittorio De Sica and Sophia Loren, the first of which was Two Women. And this was a major breakthrough film for Sophia Loren. She was already an established star in the United States. She was a starlet from Italy who played in some roles in the United States, but she returned to Italy and made a series of films with Vittorio De Sica, beginning with Two Women. The other two films I'm thinking of were Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow, and Marriage Italian Style. But Two Women was significant because, as a result of her role, she won an Oscar for Best Actress, which was the first time that a foreign actress received this award in a foreign film. This is a film that was set in World War II, and it has a very famous scene in it, if you want to call it that, a scene in which Sophia Loren and her daughter are brutally raped, gang raped, by Allied soldiers in a church, in an abandoned church. But this was her best role of her life up until that point, which really reestablished her as a star. But her films had a downside to them in the art film market because even though they were released subtitled, the plots were rather conventional. They didn't depart very much from conventional narrative forms, and they really confused the whole notion of what constitutes an art film, a foreign film, commercial film. I mean, so
because she starred in a lot of commercial films.
Yeah, precisely. And it muddied the waters, you might say. But nonetheless, these films are very successful. As a matter of fact, three of these films made it to the top 10 foreign films up until 1969.
Maybe the most famous film to come out of Italy at this point was La Dolce Vita.
Yes. It was by far the most successful film. And it ranked number one for a long period of time, but it was superseded by I'm Curious Yellow. But nonetheless, for a while, it was a top box office winner.
What was the straw? What was its appeal?
Well, this film received an awful lot of pre-release publicity, and writers stated that Fellini had culled the front pages of Italian newspapers to pick out all of the scandals that had occurred in Italy during the previous 10 years and wrap them up in this film called La Dolce Vita, which is really a satire or critique of the upper classes, and particularly the cafe society along the Via Veneto. By today's standards, it's a rather mild film, but created a lot of controversy during this period. And one could say that Fellini, in addition to satirizing the upper crust, also critiqued, you might say, the contemporary Catholic Church. There's a very famous opening scene in the film where the statue of Jesus is being carried over the rooftops of Rome by a helicopter.
The Second Coming.
The Second Coming. But also the end of the film takes place on a beach with a dead fish being pulled out of the sea. And, of course, a fish is symbolic of Christianity. Anyway, I won't say any more about what the film implies, but this was Fellini's critique, you might say, of contemporary society.
Another director of foreign films that seems to achieve star status is Ingmar Bergman.
Yes.
Can you talk about
his place in the foreign film story.
He was extremely important. You might say that he became an international phenomenon, a respected international auteur in 1956 with the release of his film Smiles of a Summer Night. And one could probably say that this is a major turning point in the history of foreign films in the United States, because for the first time, a significant auteur had achieved a level of seriousness and esteem that would compare him to the great modern novelists such as James Joyce or philosophers such as Jean-Paul Sartre. And he clearly elevated the status of the art film well beyond the traditional levels of entertainment and helped to establish film as an international art form. And one should say that he produced any number of films during this period that are now regarded as classics. After Smiles of a Summer Night, he directed
Virgin Spring.
The Virgin Spring, then Wild Strawberries, then The Magician, and then go back, The Seventh Seal. He won two Oscars in a row with The Virgin Spring and Through a Glass Darkly in 1959 and 1960. So he produced a significant body of film within a relatively short period of time. Each film, as it was released, received a tremendous acclaim by the critics.
And what were the key characteristics of his style? If you're watching a film and you say, oh, yeah, that's an Ingmar Bergman film, what does it entail?
Yes. Well, by the end of the 1950s, with all these films being released, people could almost determine what the Ingmar Bergman formula was. Typically, you know, he asked some significant questions. I mean, is God dead? And he raised existential questions. He talked about man's relationship to women. He asked questions that most significant artists might ask.
What is death?
Yeah, what is death?
Sort of the to be or not to be question.
Yes.
I picture most of his films as sort of dark in mood.
Yes,
is that
symbolic?
Indeed, they are. A famous scene from The Seventh Seal, where Max von Sydow, who is a returning crusader, plays chess with death. And, of course, he loses.
Of course.
But he's trying to play a game of chess to ward off the plague, which was terrorizing the country during this time.
Not too upbeat.
No, it wasn't. But it was a stunning film nonetheless. Part of Ingmar Bergman's success was the fact that his films were distributed appropriately. He was the only major auteur during this entire period that had a single distributor to handle his films. Most films from major European directors were handled by different distributors, which meant that these filmmakers could not receive a consistent publicity campaign when their films were released in the United States. But after the success of Smiles of a Summer Night, the success of this film convinced two art house operators to form a new company to acquire the exclusive distribution rights to Ingmar Bergman's films. And this company was Janus Films. And they promoted Bergman's films and controlled their release so that there was a consistent campaign to discuss who Ingmar Bergman was, what were his working methods, what were his goals as an artist, and so forth. And as a result of this consistent campaign, Ingmar Bergman was the subject of innumerable feature stories. He made the cover of Time magazine. His films, philosophy, background, upbringing were discussed in all kinds of magazines, Esquire magazine, you name it, the New York Times, the New York Herald Tribune. He received an enormous amount of coverage. But the coverage was relatively consistent. And what it did was, in total, was to create what we call Ingmar Bergman the auteur, or Ingmar Bergman the brand, so that everybody knew what an Ingmar Bergman film was as a result of this campaign, so that when each subsequent film was released, people knew what they were getting. And as a result of this, and these films could have been a hard sell because they did not have major entertainment elements associated with them. But Janus Films was able to milk every possible dollar out of Bergman's films. And of course, they helped to create a great reputation for art films in general. I should say that Bergman's films did not generate very much money in the United States, even though they were extremely acclaimed.
And did they use subtitles always?
Oh, yes. Yeah. They were subtitled exclusively. I'm not aware of any of his films ever being dubbed.
It's a real problem with black and white films in particular when so much of the screen is white and you have a white subtitle on top of that.
This was being discussed throughout this period as well. Some people said it would be nice to have the subtitles flashed on a separate screen or something. But, yeah, they were sometimes very difficult to read. And the art of subtitling had not progressed, or the technique, I guess I should say, had not progressed to the extent to make them immediately intelligible at all times.
We'll find out what happened to this foreign film renaissance in the United States when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Tino Baglio, who is filling us in about the foreign film renaissance on American screens, 1946 to 1973. We've been talking a lot about famous directors as if those directors are the major creative impulse behind a film, as if they have total control. You talk about a Fellini film. Who actually, though, comes up with the idea, who produces it, and who really has ultimate control over the content?
During this period, there evolved the myth of the auteur. This was a very controversial subject, especially during the 1960s. Pauline Kael and Andrew Saros argued this back and forth, and it became a very hot issue. So who was the true author of a film? Well, one could discuss it from a different way. From a practical point of view, the films of these auteurs were produced within a commercial context. They had to be financed. There had to be a producer. Many of these films were international co-productions, so subsidies had to be arranged, from different countries.
And where does the concept even come from?
Okay, well, often it came from a screenwriter. But the whole myth of the auteur that arose during this period gave the impression that the film, like Ingmar Bergman's film in particular, but others as well, germinated from the mind of the artist, the
right.
filmmaker.
Right.
And as a result of this, these films somehow come into being, and that the whole apparatus of the film industry was geared to allow this auteur to see his vision through. It seldom happened that way. These films were produced not in the rigid Hollywood context by any means, because essentially what a producer was attempting to do was to make a film by a famous auteur and using that auteur's name as a marketing device to... The producer was not making his own film. He was producing the film of a famous filmmaker. But nonetheless, there were people who contributed to the film who were seldom acknowledged in the popular press or in the press when they talked about these people. Seldom was the screenwriter ever mentioned. Seldom were the composers mentioned who composed the music. And seldom were other associates who were responsible for these films. So the illusion was that these films were created by a single artist. And what this attempted to do was to place film, these foreign films, in the same category as other creative arts, whereby a writer, a novelist, could sit down in front of a typewriter and single-handedly create a novel.
Right.
And the analogy is that these are people doing the same thing but with film.
Right.
But there was, this was somewhat different.
I opened the hour with a quotation I took from your book, but it was a quote from the cover story of Time magazine called Religion of Film. It was about the launch of the New York Film Festival.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that film festival and how that
played was around? Very important. Lincoln Center had already been constructed, and the Lincoln Center management determined what were the major art forms in the 20th century. And they built buildings, the Metropolitan Opera House, Philharmonic Hall, to house the major art forms. But there was no Motion Picture Theater in the Lincoln Center complex. But by 1963, as a result of the art film movement in the United States, the management of Lincoln Center finally acknowledged the importance of film as a 20th century art form, and as a result of this, formed the New York Film Festival. This is a special type of film festival that was modeled on the London Film Festival, which was a film festival that did not offer competitive awards, but it was a film festival that showed the best foreign or American films, for that matter, that had been produced in the previous year. So it became a showcase for the best filmmaking practices throughout the world. And this the film festival came into existence at a crucial time in my history, because by 1963, Hollywood was becoming more active in the art film market. It was looking for films that had greater commercial appeal than the typical foreign language film. So the New York Film Festival then became a showcase for films that would not normally receive distribution or exhibition in the United States. And it also served as, you might say, like a pre-release showcase for those few foreign films that came over here that had some distribution potential to them. But throughout the course of its history, New York film culture was enriched enormously by the existence of the film festival, because it, for example, introduced the Czech New Wave. It introduced the films of Bertolucci. It introduced some Japanese films. And particularly, it nurtured the career of Jean-Luc Godard, whose films would not have received much distribution during this period because of their seemingly obscure style or anti-audience attitude and so forth. But anyway, as I said, the New York Film Festival was extremely important for enriching film culture during this time, showing films that would not normally receive exhibition nor distribution under normal circumstances.
Now, you're talking in the past tense when you say at this time. The name of your book is The Foreign Film Renaissance on American Screens, 1946 to 1973. We've got 1946. Why? Right. It started then. What happened in 1973? Where did it go?
Well, that's sort of the end mark of my book. I end the book with Last Tango in Paris, a discussion of the Last Tango
famous
in Paris.
Famous Marlon Brando film.
Yes, the famous Marlon
Notorious.
Brando film. Yes. Pauline Kael wrote a 6,000-word review of this film when it first came out. And she thought that this film provided a template, you might say, for filmmakers to make films that might contain rather explicit sexual material, but films that would be couched in the traditions of traditional art films that would reach a mature audience. This film was released, it was X-rated, but it was extremely successful. But, of course, this was a film that starred Marlon Brando as well. But Hollywood and the major studios, after this point, decided they would no longer make X-rated films because of the audience limitation, the age limitation for X-rated films. X-rated films had lost their allure as a result of the rise of the pornographic film industry. And more importantly, the major studios discovered that there was a decline in cinephilia in the United States.
By cinephilia, you mean love of movies?
The love of a certain type of movie, the love of, you might say, art films. As a result of the decline of the production code in 1966 and lots of other things that were happening by the end of the 1960s, Hollywood made any number of films that were targeted at the youth audience, like Bonnie and Clyde, In the Heat of the Night, The Graduate, and so forth.
Crowther couldn't stand Bonnie and Clyde, could he?
That's right. He reviewed it three times negatively and ultimately resigned as chief critic from the New York Times as a result of this controversy. But American films being targeted at the youth audience now, in a sense, took away much of the allure of the foreign films that were being distributed at this time. So the youth audience, those who had formerly cut their teeth, you might say, on foreign films, were turning their attention to American films. The point I'm making is that Hollywood discovered that they could capture the youth audience without making sexually explicit films, but targeting a younger audience based upon their particular needs at that time.
Now, what would you say the state of foreign films today is?
Well, the only place you're going to be able to see foreign films practically at all in the United States is by going to a film festival. Foreign films practically receive no distribution in the United States at this time. Sony Picture Classics is about the only remaining art house subsidiary of a major company that continues to release an occasional foreign language film. But for the most part, the commercial market for foreign films is dead. The few films that appear are often films that have a major humanistic theme associated with them. If you look back at the foreign language films that won the Oscar in recent years, these are films that have rather conventional narrative forms. But the point I'm making is that the interest in foreign films today has reached its lowest ebb. Back in the 50s and 60s, as much as 8 to 10% of the film-going audience went to see foreign films in any given year. Today, it's less than 1%.
Wow. And how do you feel about that, Jay?
Well, there are still plenty of opportunities to see foreign films. I go to film festivals and enjoy them a lot. And of course, there's always Netflix and everything. And there's some wonderful films. I mean, audiences are being deprived of some wonderful filmmaking. But it takes a lot of money today to distribute these films, to advertise and promote them, to generate audience interest. And very few distributors are willing to take the risk when the odds against success are, you know, rather small.
So you might just have to look a little harder to find them.
Yeah.
Our guest has been Tino Baglio, and it has been an action-packed hour. And thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. I enjoyed it.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach. I hope you can join us for our next conversation on University of the Air. Next Sunday afternoon at 4 during University of the Air, we're going to look at country music with Bill Malone, who will fill us in as to how country music does and does not pertain to labor and protest and politics in general. Join us right here on Wisconsin Public Radio.